Joshua Maxwell is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas no longer has public hangings, but listen as we discuss modern-day capital punishment and witness the legal homicide of Joshua Maxwell in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Dennis Longmire, vigil reporter in Brownsville Joe Krause, and special guest Venerable Kobutsu Malone, an ordained Zen Buddhist priest who has served as a death row spiritual advisor. The Execution Watch begins.
And good evening. You're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. The name of the program is Execution Watch. It is a tradition of KPFT to do a show every time there is an execution. How this works is Elizabeth, our executive producer, is off to the other room to get on the line Professor Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston State University, who is going to give us a report from the vigil at out in front of the death chamber. Jim Skelton, who is an attorney who has had extensive practice, he's now retired, but he's been a prosecutor and a criminal defense lawyer, and he's been a mentor for so many lawyers it's impossible to keep up with him, and he still teaches lawyers the state of the law. He comes in and gives his very valuable time to us to analyze each case, and Jim will be doing an analysis of the case itself, what happened, when, how the trials went, how the appeals went. And while we are doing all of this in Huntsville, they're going through the grand ritual of executing somebody. And somewhere down the line, we're going to have a report from Brownsville, Texas, where Joe Krause is holding vigil down there. There are vigils held all over the state. And then we will continue to discuss this case and some other elements of execution until the end of the show, which will be 1 hour hence. We're waiting for Elizabeth to get back in touch with us, that Professor Longmire is on the line and ready to talk to us, and that should happen in just a few minutes. My name is Ray Hill, and Elizabeth and I, with the good assistance of Jim Skelton, came up with this idea because execution is a very serious business, and Texas does a great deal of it, and it gets to be so routine that they don't pay that much attention to the process. And so this program is to do exactly the opposite, to focus on each execution as an entity unto itself, and proceed with giving you all the information that we can glean from studying the background of cases. This is kind of a sensational case. This made a television, made-for-television movie and other things, and the chances of a last-minute intervention in this case are not optimistic. So we will proceed to give you what we have to do in going through the process. Once in a while, we'll get right. We'll get actually this far. And then suddenly there is a delay or a stay of some kind, and the execution doesn't happen. And this program becomes a developing news story program until the resolution is finally admitted. And either they proceed with the execution or they cancel the execution. In any case, we will be with you until 7 o'clock Houston time. You are listening to this program either on HD2 channel here in Houston in the broadcast range of KPFT off of 90.1 FM or 89.5 in Galveston, or you're listening to this on the Internet at executionwatch.org, which you reach either by going to theprisonshow.org or kpft.org and linked over. And I hear the pitter-patter of our executive producer's feet, and we're ready to go by telephone to Dennis. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Ray. How are you?
What's going on in Huntsville?
Well, there are five of us actually out here on the corner. I'm going to say six because there's somebody else who was here earlier who's back talking to some other people away from us. But a total of six of us out here. The witnesses have already entered the walls unit, which means that the execution is going forward. I think I counted 3 or possibly 4 people who appear to be witnessing for tonight's execution, and so.
Yeah, for Joshua.
Yes, Joshua Maxwell.
Uh-huh. Who is now 31 years old.
He is.
And what happens where Dennis is the media goes in, and then that's followed by the witnesses for the scheduled executed person. And if there are witnesses for the victims, they come through another entrance. Is there a counter demonstration tonight?
No, there is not. There's no counter demonstration. Behind us, there is a police truck from some county. I can't see what county it's from. And a couple of people who appear to be law enforcement types.
Well, this is a Bexar County case, so.
Correct, this is. But they don't appear to be. Yeah, maybe they are here because of this, but I don't know. I haven't talked to them.
Okay, Dennis, my regards to the other vigilants that you are able to talk to, and we're going to, you know, how to get in touch with Elizabeth for further developments.
Okay, very good. Thank you,
sir. And that was Dennis Longmire, who is a professor at Sam Houston State University. He teaches criminal justice, and he is loyal to the cause in that he goes to these things frequently. Jim, welcome back to the studio.
Well, thank you.
And tell us about this case.
Well, this began kind of like a Hollywood movie crime spree. It started out in around Indianapolis, Indiana, and this is where Joshua Maxwell is from. And when he was 22, he had a girlfriend named Tess McFarland. And they picked up a guy outside of Indianapolis by the name of Ronnie Bott. And then they took him to various stores, made him buy some electronics, some big screen television, things like that on his credit card. Then apparently shot him, put him in the trunk of his car, and set the car on fire. Because the next day they found the Bott's body inside the car, and he'd been shot through the abdomen. And
well, that's a sure way to get the cops there.
That'll certainly work out. And then what happened? They just kind of took off, much like, remember the Starkweather case years ago,
sure,
where that boyfriend and girlfriend off on a crime spree? Much the same way. They kind of worked their way through robberies and ended up in San Antonio about a month later. And when they were in San Antonio, they kidnapped a guy named Rudolfo Lopes, L-O-P-E-S. And he worked as a Bexar County deputy sheriff and worked in the jail. And the opinions don't tell much about how in the world Lopes came in contact with these two people, but he was working a day shift from 10 o'clock that morning to 6 that evening at the jail. And what happened, the opinions I could find and read didn't exactly tell how they met or they had any prior contact or anything, but this couple had been in San Antonio for several days. And apparently they were advertising on the some sort of internet or newspaper by date, by telephone, is how they were meeting people.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, what happened, Lopes leaves his house to go to work at 10 o'clock. At 7 o'clock that evening, somebody's using Lopes' ATM card. And they have a photograph of a woman pulling up in a car to an ATM. And where they withdrew something like $100 at one place and $300 at another. And they tried to withdraw more money, but the bank wouldn't let them, the ATM wouldn't work. And somehow, 9 o'clock that evening, Lopes was shot and killed behind a strip, behind a shopping center in San Antonio. And the reason we know that, because a couple who live nearby are watching the presidential debates, and they heard a gunshot around 9 p.m. And the following day, they found Lopes' body, and plus his brand new pickup truck. He had a gold Chevrolet pickup. It was also missing. And so they found his body. He had been tied up by telephone cords. He had been had tape over his mouth, and he was shot in the head with a 9mm pistol. And they had absolutely no idea who might have done it. They just had no early idea at this point. And then approximately about 6 days later, this couple worked their way to California doing various robberies. And so they ended up in San Francisco. And they're driving Lopes' pickup truck, and they're speeding through downtown San Francisco and almost hit a pedestrian. A policeman sees them and stops them, the two policemen in a patrol car. And they walk up to the gold pickup truck that's driven by Joshua Maxwell. And, of course, his girlfriend, Tess McFarland, is with him. And then when they start to get a ticket, he speeds off, and then there's a chase where several police cars are involved. And this is through downtown San Francisco, what they call their Garden District.
You can't hardly drive through downtown San Francisco.
Well, apparently this is what stopped him. He got clogged up in traffic. But during that chase, he started shooting at the police car, and they were shooting back at him. And he shot once through the windshield and almost hit one of the police officers that was chasing him. And during this thing, he also flipped him the bird and flipped him off with his finger during the chase. So they finally stopped the pickup truck, and they, of course, identified the pickup truck at that time as the pickup truck belonged to the dead deputy sheriff in Bexar County. Also inside the pickup truck, they found the deputy sheriff's Glock 9mm pistol. Mm-hmm. They found his identification. They found his ATM card, his Visa credit cards. And they also, the deputy sheriff always wore a gold chain across with an anchor on it that you oftentimes see. And Maxwell's wearing that gold chain.
And well, you just build up enough evidence to be sure if they do catch you, they got all they need.
Certainly saved all of it. And they found two pistols in the car. They found the Glock that had belonged to the deputy, and they found a Chinese-made Glock. And ballistics showed that the 9mm Chinese gun was the one that was used in the killing. They traced that back through ballistics to show that was a murder weapon. And his opinions don't give the body of the confessions, but he apparently confessed to both murders, the murders in Indiana. He also confessed to the murder in Texas. And he also said there was a whole series of robberies, but I'm assuming from Indiana all the way to Texas, all the way to California. There's a series of robberies because they're kind of working their way through just doing robberies. And so they bring him back to San Antonio. And they seek the death penalty because, again, it was a police officer and they killed somebody during the course of kidnapping him. Because apparently they kidnapped him sometime before 10 o'clock that morning. And apparently he was with them when they went through the ATM machines to use his card to withdraw money because he wouldn't kill. That happened around 7 o'clock in the evening. And he wasn't killed till 9 o'clock that evening. Then he really wants to guarantee he gets the death penalty. Because what he does, when he's in the Bexar County Jail, he gets into a first beating on the rails of the jail. And he's mad because they won't give him some sort of account of what he has in his prison inmate fund. And then when a jailer went to calm him down, he called him a black and used a racial epithet. Mm-hmm. And said, "I'll do the same thing to you I did to your homeboy." Then he began to imitate the deputy sheriff as the deputy sheriff begged for his life. He imitated what the deputy said, "Please don't shoot me, please don't shoot me," kind of a high-pitched voice.
Got a wife and a baby, that's right.
Right. And then he told the deputy sheriff, at least he answered back, "You don't have to worry, bitch, because you're not going to live, I'm going to kill you anyway." And he also apparently did the same thing with another inmate, in which he kind of mocked the deputy sheriff begging for his life. And that didn't help a whole lot. And on top of that, while he was in jail, he got into a fight and bloodied up. A prison guard was pretty much of a troublemaker during the time he spent in jail. And if that wasn't enough to guarantee that he would get the death penalty, when he went to trial, his girlfriend, Tess McFarland, testified against him. In exchange for that, she got a life sentence, and she's currently serving a life sentence. And she testified about all the murders. And so they promptly found him guilty because at that point, in the evidence they had him confessing, they had him possession of the deputy's property, possession of his pickup. The gun that he had was traced back to the murder, and his girlfriend testifies against him. So
it's pretty complete evidence.
It's pretty complete evidence of found guilt or innocence. Then it came time for punishment, and this is where it gets even more, but it's not bizarre, but he apparently started getting in trouble when he was 13. He did all sorts of things from burglaries to thefts, possession of marijuana, to drug offenses. Then when he became an adult, he graduated to adult crimes, began to do the same thing. There were burglaries, thefts, assaults. He ended up on probation. Probation gets revoked, and he would be sent to the penitentiary for 3 years. In fact, when he killed the man in Indianapolis, he'd been out of prison 5 months when he committed that particular murder. And they proved up, not only did they prove up his long, extensive criminal history, both as a juvenile and as an adult, even his family members testified against him. His mother said he stole from them, his ex-wife. He had, three children. In fact, he's got three living children now. And he never took care of any of his children, never paid any child support, of course, never took care of them. As a matter of fact, when they left Indianapolis, they being Tess and they being Maxwell, Tess McFarland had a rather young baby. They lived with Maxwell's mother, so we'd be back to pick her up later on. Of course, they never showed up again. And so they dumped all these children. And then one of the wives explained how she had to get a restraining order to keep him from being violent. And he was later interviewed he was interviewed by somebody at the San Antonio Express News. And he admitted then it was all just kind of a senseless crime spree that he really had no explanation for it. That the people he killed, he just kind of picked out by random. And there's several people he met in San Antonio that befriended them. He didn't kill them, but he stole from them. Mm-hmm. There was one guy that he had met prior to the murder. And he again met on that telephone dating service, whatever that was. They go to his house, and he gives them money for food. And while they're there, they steal some of his jewelry.
Mm.
And they come back and spend the night with him, apparently steal some more stuff. But apparently they stole from family members, from friends, from everybody.
And all this came to head in the trial.
All of it came out. All of that came out during the punishment hearing. And so after hearing that, the jury, of course, gave him the death penalty. And then, surprisingly enough, Indiana brought him back to Indiana to try him for the murder of the Botts man. And they gave him 65 years on that and agreed he could serve his time in Texas. He came back to Texas to serve the time because he already had the death penalty here. And that's pretty much it. You'll see these, I don't know what gets into people, but you'll often find these couples that just kind of take off. It's kind of like the natural-born killers they get in there.
That's what this was called, wasn't it?
Well, there's a movie called Natural Born Killers. I don't know if it's based on this event.
That's how they referred to it.
Okay. Well, there was a movie. I don't think the movie is based on that. But this has been a common thing. The Starkweather kid from, I think, somewhere in Nebraska, he and his girlfriend went on a killing spree. Years ago, there was a guy named Cook who took off and just kind of just killed his way through the United States. And this couple, why they selected some to kill and not to kill, we don't know. Because they met several people in San Antonio, and they just stole from them, didn't kill them.
What's a lawyer to do in a case like this?
Hope you don't get appointed on it. There's not much you can do. Now, what there was some evidence in the trial, he claimed later on that a lot of his violence came from an abusive stepfather. But during the trial, there was no evidence presented in mitigation, what we normally call a Penry instruction. Because we have a concept called, we can nickname it the Penry issue, that if somebody had a real abusive childhood, they should not be held as blameworthy as somebody who did not have an abusive childhood. And if you can introduce evidence about an abusive childhood, you can get a mitigating instruction that says this person may not deserve to die because of his unfortunate childhood. But that issue was never submitted to the jury, and they never developed any mitigation evidence.
And if you don't submit it to the jury, it's not in the record. And if it's not in the record, it's not a factor in
future
appeals.
That's exactly right. The only way you can bring it up is through a later writ claiming the lawyers were ineffective for not bringing it up. That's the only way you can really bring it up at that point. You can develop it then by way of a writ. But what's interesting, he had the traditional writs, post-conviction writ in Texas, federal writ in the district court, Fifth Circuit denies a certificate of appealability, Supreme Court denies cert. They don't even publish any of the opinions of what he said. I mean, they just summarily hammer.
So after the trial, you lose the trail, basically.
That's
because
right.
You just get the bottom line of the opinion with nothing else.
You don't even get the date the opinion came out, but you go to that page on the website, the opinion's not even there. They don't even bother to publish it.
Hmm.
And so you don't know what the issues in the writ were. I'm assuming what they probably did is what most of these writs are. Claiming the lawyer is ineffective is usually what they argue in these writs.
Well, that's the only way to get the cork out of the bottle.
That's the only way to do it. Because really the direct appeal lays a framework for all of it. And the only hope that this guy had, if you were a lawyer, what most lawyers would have done would present all the mitigating evidence about his unfortunate childhood. The problem is you've got this 22-year-old. He's 22 years old when he begins his crime spree. And, you know, kids that age are full of adrenaline and bad judgment and a lot of raging hormones. And then he did himself no good when he was in jail by mocking the deputy sheriff. And of course, they all did that, and then getting in fights with the jailers. That does him no good. Because the question is, would he be a future danger to society?
Sure.
With that sort of evidence, it'd be hard to convince a jury that he was not a future danger. And the only way, the only thing a lawyer could do is by way of mitigation to show that he had a very abusive father. That can be somewhat treacherous at times, though, because oftentimes you want to put psychiatric testimony in. And when you do, you have to give your Fifth Amendment right to have your client examined by state psychiatrists.
Mm-hmm.
And you've always got the danger when you present that evidence. If you bring in a psychiatrist, and the state psychiatrist is going to come in and claim he's a sociopath and antisocial, you open up that Pandora's box. But really the only way you could have defended this case, so there was no defense on the facts. It was all a punishment issue, and you could have drug in as much as the family as you could. And, of course, they testified, a lot of them, for the state about how he stole from them to try to show his abusive childhood from his stepfather. That's the only thing a lawyer could have done.
And then, you know, even if you got that stuff in, it is not a scientist deciding how dangerous he is now and in the future. It's a jury.
Exactly. And see, the problem is when you have somebody that, and also there was evidence that the man in Indianapolis had been tortured prior to killing him. And, you know, killing somebody is one thing, but torturing them before you kill them is something else that's quite a bit different. And killing two people during the course of robberies and kidnappings, much the same way, having a shootout with the police in San Francisco, kind of all this kind of Wild West stuff, and then robbing your way from Indianapolis to San Antonio, from San Antonio to San Francisco, working your way through robberies, it's just going to be extremely, extremely difficult to convince a jury you won't be a future danger to society.
So there's not a lot of trees killed for the appellate stuff.
They didn't. In fact, when he filed his writ in the Court of Criminal Appeals, they just simply said in an unwritten order, writ is denied and we adopt the findings of the writ judge. Because what happens when you file a writ, you file it in the convicting court. And the trial judge will get affidavits from the defense and affidavits from the state. And they'll make findings of facts, conclusions of law based on the affidavits. And if he denies relief, a lot of times what the appellate courts will simply say, we adopt the findings of the trial judge. They don't tell you what the findings are. They say we adopt them. Then he goes into the U.S. District Court in San Antonio, and they summarily deny his federal writ, and they deny him a certificate of appealability because unlike state court and federal court, you got to get consent of the district court judge to appeal. That's called a certificate of appealability. He appealed the decision not to give a certificate of appeal.
Well, he probably didn't. The lawyers did it for him.
Yeah.
And these lawyers would be appointed by
usually
the trial
appointed,
judge?
Appointed by the judges. Because what they happened, they've had so many writs, they've got a pretty good staff in most of these federal district courts that handle these writs. When it gets to the Fifth Circuit, they deny certificate of appealability. So really, they never heard the appeal at the Fifth Circuit. It died with the U.S. District Court in San Antonio. And then the Supreme Court denied an appeal, and that ended it. There was nothing written about what was said in the writs. And I'm assuming it's going to be ineffective of counsel. My gut guess would be is he was going to argue they didn't present mitigating evidence of punishment. That's what I would normally would expect it to be argued in this case, but I don't know. That's just speculation on my part. But this is kind of a short, he's 33 now?
Yeah, it's 30.
He's been on
31.
By 31. He's been on death row about nine years.
Pretty short period of time.
Because you take about the delay in the trial, that's not very much time that they've eaten up, and they certainly didn't waste any paper writing opinions about it. And then his direct appeal was what you summarily, and I hate to say it's a boilerplate brief, but he had the typical things you always hear in death penalty cases that the judge made a mistake by granting state challenges for cause on jurors and going through all of that, which is usually not very successful. He argued the evidence was insufficient factually and legally to show a kidnapping, therefore it couldn't have been capital murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then he argued, of course, that the evidence was insufficient. And he argued some kind of minor things, like the judge didn't give the right oath to the jurors and things of this nature.
Mm-hmm. And is this the kind of case that proponents of execution are going to point to and say, see, we need this punishment?
Well, the thing is that one thing that bothers me a whole lot, and I when I worked as a prosecutor in juvenile cases, I never will forget I had a kid that was like 15 years old that got busted with marijuana and his father, and we had him in custody. And his father come in ranting and raving, was going to do all these horrible things to his kid. And I said, you got to remember the kid's brain is 15 years old. Sure. He is not mature. And I said, when you were 15, you probably would have done the same thing had you had the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And what really bothers me is that a lot of kids can be pretty violent when they're going through puberty and when they're in their early 20s. But a lot of them grow out of that. They mellow as they get older. And it bothers me that age is not considered as a mitigating factor because, you know, he's only got a brain that's 22 years old.
Or maybe younger.
Younger. And then he has been in and out of all the different penal systems in Indiana. He went to juvenile detention numerous times. He went through the whole court system in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
He was on probation in Indiana and went to penitentiary in Indiana. And he gets his Ph.D. in being a criminal through
sure.
the state system. So he's educated from 13 up to he's 22 on how to be a crook and how to be violent.
Well, you know, over the years of watching criminal justice system, one of the things that that struck me as important, and I guess it's important because I used what I learned there to stop smoking. I just one day I got up and say, I am going to think of myself as a non-smoker. And soon thereafter, I was able to successfully give up that nasty habit. People in penal institutions, criminals, do not reach the point where they decide they are non-criminals. And that becomes their lifetime identity. And then there's patterns of behavior developed behind that. Where that they're in competition for being a worse outlaw than the other outlaws that they know. Now, I don't know, because I'm, number one, not a scientist. I'm just, you know, this old ex-convict who has opinions. I think that's very valid in a lot of cases. And some of these completely lost cases where you've got crime sprees of this shocking degree, I think those people are living the lives of an identity that they have adopted and are motivated by internal drives that don't make sense to the rest of us.
I think you're right, because you take this kid, he starts getting in trouble at just as soon as he hits 13.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently a lot of the stuff he was doing was reaction to having an overbearing and cruel and harsh stepfather. So he's already violent and mad at the age of 12, 11, 12, and 13. Then he gets thrown into juvenile detention, and they learns more violence. And from there he goes to prison. And like I say, it's kind of like a roadmap on how to be a violent criminal. Because you think about it. He spent from the years 13 till he was 21. What's that? Almost 9 years. Almost half of his life. First off, the first half of his life, he was living in a home where apparently there was not much love because of the stepfather. And then the next half of his life, he's thrown in with a bunch of people who live by a violent code. And he's trying to form an identity. Because you know what it's like growing up as a teenager. You're trying to form an identity and get some worth about yourself as a person. If they start identifying themselves as crooks and thinking themselves as crooks, thinking it's, you got to be tough and macho, and you turn somebody loose, with all the laws you have restricting convicts from getting jobs, what the hell are you going to do when you're 22 and you've got a long, extensive record of stealing?
Yeah,
what do you do?
How do you get back to any kind of normalcy? How do you get back to any kind of lifestyle that would make sense in an ordered society?
And they team up with people. And again, I don't know much about this gal Tess, but obviously she wasn't the most ideal mother dumping her child with.
No, the classic example of that is Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie probably was, you know, kind of fascinated by a tough guy, Clyde, and that was part of the charm of their attraction of their relationship. But she became a bigger outlaw than he was.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me tell the audience what's going on here while Elizabeth puts Mr. Cruz. Is that Cruz?
Krause.
Mr. Krause on. The deal is that We are now past the time Professor Longmire should have called us. So something is going on in the execution chamber that is delaying the culmination of that process. Rather than me speculate on what that might be, I can only alert you that there has been more time in this process than there has been in any other process, save once where we had a stay that was withdrawn after granted at the last moment. And we were not expecting that development in this case. Mr. Krause.
Yes.
You are on the air. Tell us what is going on in Brownsville.
We had our regular vigil for every scheduled execution. There were six of us there with banners at a very busy intersection in Brownsville. We stay there from 5 to 6, and then at 6 o'clock we have a prayer vigil. The organizations that are involved are Pax Christi Brownsville and the United Methodist Church, and we are now joining together to form a chapter of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
And you do this with each execution?
Yes, we've been doing this for the last 3 years.
Well, I can tell you this from my perspective. I've been doing this show for better than a year, and this process has taken longer because normally when we come in here to do a show, we hear back from the vigil in Huntsville, about 6:20, 6:25 max out. And it is now past 6:30, and we have not heard a word from them. So this process of execution, the ritual, and I see it as a cold, premeditated ritual. The ritual is taking longer this time, and I can only speculate what's going on. I don't know whether Joshua Maxwell is giving them a hard time or whether the needles in the veins are not working. I don't know what's going on, but I do know that it is taking longer for that to happen this time than usual.
But we have to remember that because of the Hippocratic Oath, medical personnel will not participate. Consequently, you run the risk always of some very unexpected and unintended difficulties. But that's part of the fact that it's done by amateurs.
Yeah, well, it's inherently done by amateurs, and that's bothersome along with the rest of it. I mean, I find the whole thing bothersome. I just wished, as you do, that we would get out of the practice.
The vengeance and the inhumanity of the whole process is really most unfortunate.
Mr. Krause, how do people get in contact with Pax Christi and the other organizations your coalition represents?
Easiest way is just to call me at 956-831-4354.
We got to do numbers slowly because we're after all radio. 956-831-4354.
That's correct. We're a very small organization. We do not have any website or anything like that. So that's the easiest way to get in contact with us.
Well, thank you very much for participating in Execution Watch, Mr. Krause, and we appreciate hearing from you. Give our regards to the vigilance there in Brownsville.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And that was Joe Krause, and Joe comes to us from Brownsville, where they have been doing these vigils for some time. And now we're going to go to our guest for today when Elizabeth gets it set up. Jim, any more comments? I was passed a note by our old friend here saying apparently this guy was a different kind of normal.
See, normals, I don't know what normal is.
It's a town in Oklahoma, I think.
Well, And I worked at the psychiatric, I worked in Wakely School working in psychiatric wards. And going from that world to University of Texas, where we had co-eds that looked like they were wearing Green Bay Packer football helmets, sure, and pinky rings, you begin to wonder what normal is. And the problem is, if you're raised in a juvenile criminal culture, what's normal to you is to be a criminal and crook to get by. Because normal is different things to different people. And it might have been normal behavior based upon his environment that he lived in. Because I've oftentimes wondered why they don't put the penal institutions on trial, because they've escaped responsibility thus far. When we have all these death penalty discussions, very little is ever discussed about the way that people are treated when they're incarcerated that make them more violent than when they first went in. And it seems to me that there should be some accountability to our prison system for producing people.
Dennis finally has got back in touch with us, and we're going to find out what's going on there. Dennis?
Yes, Ray.
What's going on?
Well, about 3 or 4 minutes ago, the witnesses came back out of the walls unit, which, as you know, is a signal to us that the execution is over, and it appears to have gone forward. It did seem to linger, and so I'm interested in reading in the paper to see if there was any reason for a little bit of a delay.
Well, John Grazik will give us a report in the morning press.
Unfortunately, I suspect he's already written it, and so maybe we'll get it online before the evening is over. But the execution is over. And it is another sad night for the citizens of Texas that we've gone forward with this brutal and totally unnecessary act.
Yeah, I was exchanging notes with Joe Krause, who's down in Brownsville at the vigil. And those folks down there gather heartily on busy streets, and then they go hold a service during this process. And they are with Pax Christi and other organizations that are trying to work toward the end of execution. And, Mercy, you got a little traffic over there, I understand.
Yes, some motorcyclists just sped by.
Yeah. But thank you for your vigilance.
Okay. Well, thank you for everything you do.
Thank you. And Dennis Longmire is a professor at Sam Houston State University. What's the best way to get in touch with you, Dennis?
Google Longmire, shsu.edu. That's the best way to get through to me.
Sam Houston State University.edu. Thank you, sir.
All right.
And that was Dennis Longmire, friend of the prison show and friend of Execution Watch. By the way, if you go to executionwatch.org, if you're listening to this on HD2 channel, you will find that we have a back page, a lot of details about Joshua Maxwell. It doesn't quite reach the depth of the characterization in Jim Skelton's voice. Jim's able to tell this with intonations that bring the story to life for you during the short broadcast. I gather that Elizabeth is out trying to find the venerable Kabushu, Malone, who is the spiritual counselor. We're going to squeeze him in. Is the venerable on the air?
Venerable Kobatsu.
Kobatsu. All right. And Venerable Kobatsu Malone. Kobatsu.
Hello, Ray. Good evening.
I'm not pronouncing anything right tonight. So would you please do that correctly for us?
Kobatsu.
Kobatsu. Okay. Did you know Joshua?
I don't believe I met him. I did a tour of the Texas death row. I met a lot of men one day, and I may have met him, but the names escaped me. It was a whirlwind thing.
Yeah. Tell us what you do.
I'm sorry. Excuse me?
Tell us what you do in respect to Texas executions.
Well, not bloody much. I do all the political petition writing, letter writing, and things like that. But my actions are thus far ineffective, as are everyone else's.
Yeah, as are ours and everyone else's. I mean, it is a concern that is bent toward frustration.
It's frustrating, yes, and every other state, Texas in particular, but every other state that has and maintains the death penalty is in the same position.
Do you have the opportunity to comfort some of those destined for execution?
I do the best I can. Most of the guys that I correspond, well, all of the guys that I'm involved with now, I correspond with because I'm not in a death penalty state, and I'm kind of limited to my traveling these days.
Well, you know, it's amazing that Buddhism has, well, the whole Eastern thought is something that's very effective at dealing with people incarcerated. Certainly not just those on execution watches, but those in general population. I know Bolozov has been a friend of the prison show for some time. And getting access to teach meditation and other affirmative practices in those environments is not easy.
It's still an uphill battle, Ray. When I first began teaching in Sing Sing prison, we were told that what we were doing was we were essentially practicing a religion that we weren't authorized to practice.
And that was in New York, right?
It was 8 years of that.
8 years of that.
Every single step of the way, there was a battle to be fought. And we finally got to the point where they recognized that if we wanted something, we had good reason for it. And they knew damn well if they denied it that they'd wind up in court. And after that, things got quite a bit more easy. They were rather gracious because they realized that we were serious and we ran a very tight ship, a very tight program. And as a matter of fact, the Department of Ministerial and Family Services sort of held up our program as kind of a flagship of what Buddhism could do in the prisons. But they weren't very helpful.
Well, I think the record of taking Buddhism and Buddhist thought into prisons is pretty well established as a successful means of altering whole thinking patterns and improving the product, that's discharging inmates, with a lower rate of recidivism, simply because you're awakening something that is within them that apparently has not been touched.
Well, every single individual has that potential for awakening, whether they're in or out of prison. And the thing with prison is that you've got a lot of time on your hands. And those guys, most of the guys that I've worked with are doing, you know, long bits, and they're doing, you know, some very serious time. And those kind of guys are really the ones that are doing the deep looking, the deep penetrating practices, because they're quite serious about it. The guy that's in for a year or two, hell, he just wants to do his time and you know, get the hell out.
He's, yeah, I actually think there's some advantages
for any kind of life-changing endeavors, whereas the guys that are doing long, hard time are. And the guys that are on death row in particular, they're approaching their demise, and they get real serious.
Yeah, I think there's some advantages to having those big numbers, because I went to Texas prison, sentenced to 160 years. I assumed that I was going to be there for the rest of my life. And so I had the time to spend some time meditating and learning how to use Zen to handle pain. And that worked out. I still use that.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you learn a process that works, you don't abandon it.
Well, I can only hope that all the guys that went through my program, some of them were able to take some of it with them. Many of them I've had no follow-up with. Sing Sing Prison is a transport prison in that they bring in everyone from New York City and the surrounding areas into the prison for classification and then distribution. So at any given time, one half the population is in transit. So many of the guys that used to come to my program, they'd be there for a while, and then poof, one night they disappear.
Well,
Hear from them again.
Well, it's a lifetime journey, but you don't necessarily have to have mentors to make it. I mean, you're fixing to go to Japan, I understand. And what's the purpose of all that?
Well, actually, I'm not heading for Japan. I was there about 4 years ago. I spent some time with my son, who was training in Sogenji Monastery in Okayama.
Uh-huh.
And I'm essentially a student of the abbot there, who I took to the Arkansas death row back in 2000. And he is currently, we're awaiting word on the situation with Dynan, Jack Harold Jones in Arkansas, who has a date for the 16th. And this afternoon, he just received a stay.
Mm-hmm.
We're sort of on pins and needles waiting to hear about this stay and whether, you know, how fast the Attorney General decides to, you know, pursue the appeal and everything. It may or may not hold. That remains to be seen. But on the 16th, my abbot, Venerable Shoto Harada Roshi, is scheduled to come to Arkansas to be with Dynan, Jack, when he is executed. And if this happens on that date, according to schedule, then Shoto Harada Roshi will become the first Japanese Zen master to witness an execution on American soil.
Mercy. How easily do you get access in Arkansas?
To the
inmate.
To the prisoners?
Yeah.
Actually, it's not too bad. Arkansas is pretty simple. I mean, the prisoner essentially fills out a religious adherence form and then lists the names of clergy or, you know, lay people are involved, and then they go through a vetting process and they're approved.
And he plans on becoming a monk, or he is a monk?
No, he can't become a monk.
He cannot become a monk.
He can't do the training. It's not possible to do the training.
Okay, it's not possible for that to happen. I had a volunteer on the prison show who taught creative writing to inmates on the show, specifically those in solitary confinement that don't have access to other education. And she did that for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden she went off to become a Buddhist nun.
Right.
Because of that spiritual journey for her. And so it kind of lightened me. I had an enlightenment about how spiritual some of our ordinary work with inmates can be to people not accustomed to doing what we're used to doing every day.
Well, prison work is a minefield. And it's both rewarding and disappointing. It's entirely up to the individual, and like everything, it changes on a day-to-day basis. Many times I felt disappointed, and at times mildly rewarded. But it's difficult work. It's not easy.
Well, thank you, Venerable Kobutsu Malone, for being with us. Our regards to your abbot, and thank him for his concern for life in this country.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciated being on the show. Good
thank
luck.
You, sir. And we may have you back for further development of these ideas.
Well, I'm at your service.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
And that was an interesting person, Venerable Kobutsu Malone.
Kobutsu.
And he is, where is he now? He's not in execution. He's in Maine. Yeah, Maine doesn't execute up there. Those folks have an almost Scandinavian.
Living there is a death penalty.
It's on that booming coast.
Yeah.
Okay, Jim.
He lives in a remote village on the Maine coast.
Oh, okay, Jim. This one was pretty expected to go through.
Sure. I want to go back to something we talked about earlier. Richard Pryor, talking about being normal.
Sure.
Richard Pryor had a wonderful routine talking about what's normal for a black man to feel. Said, you know, you lack your cops. You're not used to getting out and you're working all day and you're a black man. You go home and you clean up. You take your wife out to eat and you're driving down the highway and all of a sudden a cop stops you and someone hollers, get out of that car, you blankety blank, so and so. You look just like a blankety blank that robbed the place and they shake you down. And then he says, who feels like going to eat after that? And so what would be normal for somebody raised in that culture would be entirely, at least normal how they look at policemen, is entirely different than what would be normal for someone who lives in the suburbs of a white, pristine white community. And by the same token, we talk about normal. This guy might be normal from the environment that he was reared and raised in.
Mm-hmm.
That might be normal conduct. And you think about this for a moment. How would you like to have your entire life dictated on the judgment you used when you were a 22-year-old man?
Mm.
So you go back and think about the things about your life that has changed since when you were 22 as opposed to what it is now. How would you like to be held accountable by the judgments and ideas you had when you were 22 that would carry through today? And especially if you go back and look at the environment that this 22-year-old was reared in.
Mm-hmm.
And so for him, being normal is probably to get by, is to be violent and to take care of yourself. And you don't work that stuff out. You don't work out anger from a bad childhood. You don't work out anger from bad experiences. Now, two things that will cure that is age and time.
Sure.
And he didn't have the age or the time to ever work this out. And again, and I don't know anything about his IQ. He went as high as the 10th grade. But as a general rule, when somebody's a little bit slow and stupid and they come from that abusive childhood, there's absolutely no hope for them.
Well, wouldn't most of those 10 grades have been in an institution somewhere?
Of course they would have been. Of course they would have been.
And what is the 10th grade like at a reformatory?
Probably like the third grade is in most schools. And, you know, if you're a little bit intelligent, you can overcome that anger. It takes a long time to do it. Because you spent 10 years in a cesspool, you're not going to take one bath and clean all the dirt off. It's going to take a while to change all of that. And like I say, it always has bothered me that age has not been a mitigating factor in death penalty cases, because I would hate to think that I have to live by the judgments I made when I was 22 years old, that would dictate what the rest of my life.
Well, the only factor actually they consider is how horrible the crime. How emotionally do we react to this crime?
The truth of the matter is the death penalty is for one thing alone, and that's revenge. Because what they're basically saying is you've done an unconscionable act, and because you've done this unconscionable act, we don't really care why. We're going to kill you.
And it was so bad that we are sure that you're going to do it again, whether there's any evidence of that or not.
Well, they're going to make sure you don't.
Yeah.
And really, the death penalty, the major reason they have it raised, or revenge, that's the only purpose of the death penalty, is vindictiveness and revenge.
Now, there's some bad dudes out there.
Well, there really are. But you can also lock up these bad dudes.
Yeah, prison is a nice place for a bad dude.
Old age and arthritis will take care of most of
right,
the bad
right, right. Yeah, by the time you get to be 60 or 70 years old, you've got your prostate's giving you hell.
Yes.
And your bones begin to creak, and arthritis is coming in, and that life of crime is not nearly as romantic as it was when you were 70.
Like Willie Nelson said, you learn the going up ain't worth the coming down. And it's hard to kill somebody if you're in a walker.
Yeah, right. How do you hold a gun and navigate?
Hit them with your cane, I suppose, but you can't do a hell of a lot of damage because you're too weak. You might drop the cane and pee in your pants when you did it.
Excuse us for laughing on this very serious program, but we're glad that that you've joined us tonight, because Jim and I have to deal with these issues, and some of these issues are not pretty.
This one isn't.
But sometimes we run across one where Jim and I are sitting here looking at one another. I can't believe they're killing this guy because he didn't do it.
Well, this guy, there's no question he did it. There's no.
Yeah. Now his girlfriend is somewhere in a Texas prison, doing a life sentence, and her chances for parole are not affirmative. Of course, at this point, at 9 years, she may have life without possibility of parole.
They didn't do it back then. They didn't have life without parole.
So she's talking about life 20 or life 40?
Life 40.
Life 40. She's talking about life 40 years old. And ever how old she was when she went in there, what is she going to be like 40 years after that sentence came down? I'll leave it to you folks to figure that out. But I went visited a women's prison up in Marlin, Texas recently, I don't know how you describe that atmosphere. It's different from men's prisons. It's actually in many ways more masculine than a men's prison, and I found that surprising. But prisons are not nice places. They're very expensive. You taxpayers are paying an awful lot of money for incarcerating people. And it's not because of the luxuries. That's what security costs. And the cost of security is spiraling because of all the airport stuff and the homeland security stuff. And every school has got its own police department, and that not only requires people to actually do the policing, but it requires people to supervise all of that. Half of Houston Police Department right now is featherbedding one way or another. They're not actually out trying to solve crimes. They're holed up and on the payroll, blogging the news stories in Houston Chronicle. You know, if you're in the fire department, you can hang around the shack and work on your internet
and muscles.
Logging and work on your muscles until it's time to go out and fight a fire. But in police, you should be a little more alert for longer periods of time. But they're beginning to think more like firefighters all the time. Well, you're listening to Execution Watch. I am Ray Hill on radio station KPFT HD2 channel. Our staff tonight is executive producer Elizabeth Stein, who went to all the work to put the show together. Our technical director is the real wizard, and that is Otis McClay, and he is in the other room making sure that you can hear this. Jim Skelton is our regular analyst, and he's in here to do this good work. I am Ray Hill. We have Dan Grunstrom in here as the Peanut Gallery, giving us some encouragement. And Dan and I and Elizabeth are all part of The Prison Show, and you can see us on this coming Friday. The music is Death by Texas by Victoria Panetti. Thank you for listening, and good night.